called Cabo de Santa Cruz. Two ships were sent ahead to receive the promised victuals. Unbeknownst to the expeditioners, somewhere in the Caribbean Sea or the Gulf of Mexico, billowing clouds and localized thunderstorms began to clash and combine with each other, and this mass of clouds, rain, and wind started to rotate around a low-pressure center due to the Earth's spinning motion. In the course of 2 or 3 weeks, the wind must have picked up steadily until the system developed into a tropical storm and finally a hurricane, and it drifted toward Cuba. Narvaez's two lead vessels arrived at Trinidad on a Thursday. The next morning, the weather began to turn bad, with occasional squalls and high surf. Since the town was located about 3 miles inland, Vasco Porcayo, Juan Pantoja, one of the vessel captains, and some men went ashore to receive the provisions. Cabeza de Vaca remained aboard in command of the two ships. He waited all of Friday and part of Saturday as the storms continued to increase in intensity. The pilots were worried because the anchorage was poor and exposed and the weather was not letting up. Sometime in the course of Saturday morning, a canoe reached Cabeza de Vaca's ship. A messenger carried a letter requesting him to go to town to oversee the transfer of provisions. The royal treasurer refused to move, explaining that he could not leave his post under the circumstances. By noon, the canoe had returned, this time with a horse and another letter urging Cabeza de Vaca's immediate presence. At last, Cabeza de Vaca relented and headed toward Trinidad. Then, the hurricane hit. The great majority of the Florida expeditioners had never experienced such a towering, rotating giant, shuffling erratically from place to place and smothering everything in its path. Because hurricanes require tropical heat and high humidity to form, they do not occur anywhere in the Mediterranean or the northeastern Atlantic. Columbus was the first to report one during his second voyage. European residents of Española and Cuba had some encounters with them in the early decades, adopting the Taino word for them, huracán, meaning big wind. Cabeza de Vaca could not hide his astonishment. At this time, the sea and the storm began to swell so much that there was no less tempest in the town than at sea, because all the houses and churches blew down, and it was necessary for us to band together in groups of 7 or 8 men, our arms locked with one another, in order to save ourselves from being carried away by the wind. We were as fearful of being killed by walking under the trees as among the houses, since the storm was so great that even the trees, like the houses, fell. In this great storm and continual danger, we walked all night without finding an area or place where we could be safe for even half an hour. Throughout the night, the natives of Trinidad chanted and played bells and flutes and tambourines to appease Guabansesh, the female spirit that moves the wind and water and tears down the houses and uproots the trees. Interestingly, Spaniards, not unlike the natives, understood hurricanes as manifestations of the devil. In the wake of 2 devastating hurricanes in 1508 and 1509, Española residents set out to protect themselves by building stone churches endowed with large crosses. As one early chronicler explains, devout Christians affirm, and experience has shown, that after the most holy sacrament has been placed on the churches and monasteries of this city, Santo Domingo, and other towns of this island, the hurricanes have ceased. The following day, on Monday, Cabeza de Vaca and about 30 survivors of the expedition who had remained in Trinidad went to the shore to find out what had happened to the ships. There were only a few traces of them at the anchorage, some buoys, but nothing more. Search parties moving along the coast found a rowboat atop a tree close to 1 mile away. At a distance of more than 25 miles, they recovered 2 bodies so bludgeoned that they were impossible to identify. They also found a cape and some blanket rags. All in all, that day, the Florida expedition lost 2 ships, 20 horses, and 60 men to the strange ways of the New World. The God-fearing survivors could only interpret this violent storm as a divine warning, an unmistakable omen. Chapter 3. Landfall. The hurricane left the Florida expedition in disarray. The departure date had to be postponed to replace the lost ships and replenish the dwindling colonists. Meanwhile, Narvaez had a brewing insurrection on his hands. According to Cabeza de Vaca, the men became so terrified by what had happened in Cuba that they greatly feared embarking again in winter, and they begged the governor to spend it there. Such a delay would have constituted a considerable financial setback. But Narvaez ultimately relented because he too needed more time. Ever since the one-eyed Captain General had begun raising his armada in Seville, he had been unable to find a pilot familiar with Florida and the northern Gulf Coast. It was no small hindrance. As any experienced explorer knew well, a pilot is to the ship what the soul is to the human body. Without one, the entire venture would be in grave danger. Experienced pilots were quite simply indispensable in an age when the contours of a new continent were just becoming visible to Europeans. Aided only by basic compasses and charts, they navigated through treacherous waters, relying on sea lore and their own painstakingly acquired experience. Pilots had to be able to recognize coastlines, read the weather for signs of impending storms, and learn to estimate depth by only looking at the color of the sea. Deep blue was safe. Light blue meant a sandy bottom but not much depth. Brown was the ominous color of coral. Their worth was all too evident in the enormous salaries they commanded, the size of which kept increasing throughout the 16th century. Yet good pilots were notoriously scarce. During his stay in Seville, Narvaez had been unable to locate a pilot familiar with Florida and the Gulf Coast. The situation was not better at Española, and the Captain General was forced to leave the island empty-handed. Cuba offered a final opportunity. Over the winter of 1527 to 1528, Cabeza de Vaca stayed with the ships at the spacious and protected port of Jagua, present-day Cienfuegos, on the southern coast of Cuba, while Narvaez traveled about looking for a suitable navigator. When the Captain General rejoined his party in February, he brought along a man by the name of Diego Miruelo. Miruelo had a reputation as a very fine pilot of the northern Gulf Coast. Most importantly, he was reputed to have been to the Rio de las Palmas. Little is known about Miruelo and about the true extent of his experience as a pilot, but he had quite likely traveled through some portions of the Gulf Coast and could claim some competence. Unfortunately, as Narvaez would soon discover, Miruelo's skills as a pilot were inadequate to the mission ahead. Narvaez's charge was to settle the land between the Rio de las Palmas and Florida. Florida constituted the northern end of this region. By the 1520s, it was still an enigma. Only a handful of European fleets had actually visited this flat, subtropical peninsula. Even these early explorers had seen it mostly from the decks of their ships. Spanish slavers operating in the Bahamas were among the first to drift into Florida, as the scarcity of natives on the islands propelled them to extend their activities farther west. Some of these traffickers were surely the first Europeans to behold Florida. The glory of Florida's discovery belongs to a veteran explorer named Juan Ponce de León. In 1513, he set out to discover an island called Bimini, thought to exist north of the Bahamas. Some early chroniclers claim that Ponce de León was looking for the Fountain of Youth, although he never said so explicitly. Nonetheless, such a quest would not have been unthinkable. Early explorers cast off into distant lands, driven by gold, but also by a wellspring of legends that included mermaids, Amazon warriors, pygmies, the seven cities of Cibola, the mines of King Solomon, the rich kingdom of Prester John, and many other wondrous sights and creatures. Ponce de Leon found neither Bimini nor the Fons Juventutis, but he did reach Florida's Atlantic coast, somewhere near what is now Cape Canaveral. Since this first official sighting occurred during the Pascua Florida, or Flowery Festival, as Easter was known, Ponce de Leon called this new land La Florida. His three ships then sailed southward, surveying the peninsula to present-day Miami and around the Florida Keys. Other Europeans, particularly slavers, must have made their way there in the 1510s and 1520s. But none of them had the authorization or the inclination to plant permanent settlements. Narvaez's enterprise was intended to establish three forts and two towns somewhere in this area. But it was not Florida proper that Narvaez was after, but rather the riches farther south. Narvaez's first objective was the Rio de las Palmas. This river, today's Rio Soto la Marina, runs parallel to the Rio Grande, some 125 miles to the south. It served as the demarcation between Narvaez's territory to the north and the province of Panuco to the south. In the early 1520s, Panuco had been the object of intense rivalry, as it was both well-populated and easily accessible by sea. In other words, immensely appealing to anyone involved in the slaving business. The Rio de las Palmas constituted an obvious gateway into this economically attractive area. The river itself was rumored to contain fabulous riches, despite the fact that earlier explorers had found nothing of the kind. It also had strategic value. The river is navigable and constitutes a visible geographic feature on the Gulf Coast. Its delta had been considered an auspicious site for a European settlement since the first Europeans arrived. Exploring and controlling the Rio de las Palmas was Narvaez's top priority. Narvaez would also have to decide what other areas to explore and colonize within the lands apportioned to him. It was an immense area. According to a 1527 report that sought to clarify the political divisions of North America, Narvaez's adelantamiento included everything between the Rio de las Palmas and the northern boundary of Florida, going west all the way to the other sea. This expansive interpretation amounts to a swath of land measuring more than 470 miles from north to south and 2,500 miles across from the Atlantic to the Pacific, encompassing portions of today's Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, Tamaulipas, Nuevo León, Coahuila, Durango, Chihuahua, New Mexico, Sinaloa, Sonora, Arizona, and Baja California. Spaniards of the 1520s knew practically nothing about these territories, but they already had inklings of their enormity. The 1527 report ruefully implied that the emperor had been much too generous with Narvaez, as it would take three princes, each of them with a large armada, to subdue and rule this immense space. In fact, the area in question is four times larger than Spain. But Narvaez was not alone in laying claim to the territories north of Mexico. Well-connected, resourceful, and ambitious conquistadors were already engaged in a headlong race for the occupation and control of large portions of North America. At the top of the list of potential rivals was the richest man in the New World, and Narvaez's old nemesis, Hernán Cortés. As early as May 1522, an exultant Cortés had written to Charles V, informing him that he had reached the Pacific Ocean. "And I have already begun building ships and brigantines to explore all the secrets of this coast that is 90 leagues from here, Mexico City, and which undoubtedly will reveal marvelous things." Cortés established a shipyard on the Pacific coast and started launching fleets to the north that would eventually reach Baja California and other areas that Narvaez could claim. It seemed as though the two men were destined to clash once again in the distant Pacific coast. In addition to the looming threat of Cortes, Narváez faced two fierce competitors on either side of his adelantamiento on the Atlantic side. To the north, Narváez had to contend with none other than the licenciado Lucas Vázquez de Ayón, the mediator sent by the Audiencia of Santo Domingo to prevent a showdown between Narváez and Cortés in Mexico. The ubiquitous Vázquez de Ayón was a man of great learning and gravity, for whom 24 hours was not enough time in the day for his multiple occupations, beginning with his colorful private life. Although married, he had one or more illegitimate children and quite possibly kept a neighbor's wife in his house as a concubine. Beyond his romantic pursuits, Vázquez de Ayón owned a sugar plantation and was also an enthusiastic participant in the slave trade. He sponsored slaving expeditions to the Bahamas, but his ships were so poorly provisioned that many of the captives died in transit. Vázquez de Ayón's interest in North America stemmed from this last facet of his career. One of his slaving expeditions drifted far to the northeast, eventually reaching the coast of South Carolina. This serendipitous discovery enabled Vázquez de Ayón to travel to Spain and request a patent to explore and colonize this region. In the summer of 1526, when Narváez was still lobbying in the Spanish court, the licenciado sailed to the coast of America with approximately 600 colonists. That set the stage for a head-on collision with Narváez's future settlements in Florida. There was no love lost between the two leaders. The confrontation was averted only because Vázquez de Ayón became ill and died in October 1526. Factional disputes following the licenciado's death eventually compelled everyone to abandon the settlement. Narváez faced a far more significant threat to the south of his adelantamiento, in the province of Pánuco. Pánuco had attracted powerful figures since the early 1520s. In 1525, 2 years before Narváez embarked on his own expedition, the crown had appointed an independent-minded governor of Pánuco named Nuño de Guzmán. Reputed to be a great villain, Guzmán arrived at Santi Esteban del Puerto, Pánuco's only non-Indian settlement, with a head start of more than a year over Narváez. A drab community of perhaps 60 or 70 Spaniards, Santi Esteban del Puerto was at the time Europe's northernmost foothold on the continent, and an excellent base for further exploration. Guzmán began his tenure by exploring the famous Rio de las Palmas. Guzmán's subsequent career reveals how much of a risk he posed to Narváez. In the early 1530s, he would go on to conquer the northwest coast of Mexico all the way to Sinaloa and Sonora, while maintaining an iron grip over Pánuco. He then attempted to join his two coastal domains into one single territorial and political entity, stretching from one coast to the other. Guzmán was a serious threat. Having spent the winter in Cuba, the expeditioners resumed their journey in February 1528. But they ran into trouble almost immediately. Only 3 or 4 days after the expedition set sail from the port of Jagua, the new pilot, Miruelo, revealed worrying signs of incompetence when the ships began running aground in the archipelago of Canarreo. Comprised of some 350 verdant islets in the Gulf of Batabano to the southwest of Cuba, Canarreo is surrounded by a treacherous maze of reefs, shallows, and jagged rocks. Navigating these shallows was a nightmare for shipmasters and pilots, and Miruelo was not up to the task. And we were in this predicament for 15 days, the keels of the ships frequently touching bottom, Cabeza de Vaca writes, after which time a storm caused by the south wind brought so much water into the shallows that we were able to get out, although not without great danger. Embarrassingly, the expedition was about to meet its end right at Cuba's doorstep. The problems continued. At Guaniguanico, a storm overtook the fleet. We were nearly shipwrecked, recounts Cabeza de Vaca. At Cabo de Corrientes, the expedition encountered another tempest that lasted for 3 days. After rounding Cape San Anton, Cuba's westernmost tip, The fleet sailed upwind along Cuba's northern coast, where it was caught by yet another storm before entering Havana's harbor sometime in late February or March. Many explorers feared that God was bent on destroying the fleet, citing as proof the hurricane, the shallows of Canarreo, and the three consecutive storms. Everyone, but especially the pilot Miruelo, must have felt a sense of enormous relief upon reaching port. In early spring of 1528, Narvaez's reconfigured expedition finally headed toward the mainland. Their destination was the critical Rio de las Palmas. During their passage across the Gulf of Mexico, Miruelo's skill was put to the test once again, this time with disastrous results. After several days of sailing, the pilots saw land and convinced themselves that they were close to the Rio de las Palmas, when in fact the expedition had drifted only to present-day Tampa Bay on the west coast of Florida. They were still within Narvaez's enormous adelantamiento, but at the wrong end. Miruelo had misjudged the fleet's location by more than 900 miles. It was a dramatic error with deadly consequences. Miruelo's lack of skill may have been partly to blame for this colossal mistake, but so too were the limitations of 16th-century navigation, coupled with the peculiar challenges posed by the Gulf of Mexico. In the 16th century, the basic method of ocean navigation was dead reckoning. Pilots steered ships from an origination point or fix to a new position by estimating the direction and distance traveled. Any point on the globe could be specified by means of only direction and distance. To keep track of direction, navigators used a 32-point magnetic compass. To judge the distance traveled, pilots estimated the speed of the ship by simply looking at the passing bubbles on the sea. During the Age of Discovery, this disarmingly simple system was used with accuracy to negotiate even long ocean passages. Dead reckoning navigation, for instance, enabled Columbus to sail four times from Spain to the Caribbean and back. Dead reckoning navigation, in turn, was made possible by a new type of chart known as a portolan. Invented in the 13th century, the portolan chart caused a nautical revolution, first in the Mediterranean and later in the Atlantic. Unlike medieval mappae mundi, with their fanciful renderings of land masses and distances, portolan charts are incredibly accurate. One can gain a sense of their accuracy by comparing conventional maps of the 16th century, which often exaggerate the length of the Mediterranean by nearly 20 degrees, a problem traceable to Ptolemy, with portolan charts, for which the comparable error seldom exceeds 1 degree. Intended for real working seamen, portolan charts include only relevant geographic details like coastlines, islands, rivers, and mountains. But their most visually striking and useful feature is the series of lines bisecting the charts. These lines were the lifeblood of 16th century navigators. Each one represents what pilots called a rutter, derrotero in Spanish, or technically a rum line, a path defined by a fixed compass direction. These were the lines that pilots strove to follow as they steered the ships through the oceans. Portolan charts thus gave pilots information about the distance between point A and point B, the precise direction that they needed to follow, and indications about any prominent geographic features along the way. All they needed to know, nothing more and nothing less. Crucially, portolan charts do not depend on latitudes or longitudes. Indeed, virtually no portolan charts contained such measurements prior to 1500. Moreover, they do not require the use of declination tables or any additional conversions or calculations, as these charts were drawn on the basis of the magnetic rather than the true north. Simply by maintaining a course with a magnetic compass and keeping track of the distance traveled on a portolan chart, an illiterate pilot, and roughly one out of four pilots in the 16th century was still unable to write his own name, could steer an expedition skillfully and safely to its destination. Like most pilots of his time, Miruelo must have navigated by the tried and true method of dead reckoning. It is entirely possible that Mihuelo did not know the latitude, let alone the longitude, of the Rio de las Palmas, and lacked the ability to determine his position except by reference to familiar land features. In the 1520s, only some pilots were able to navigate by alturas, that is, by using a cross staff to measure the angle formed by the sun and the horizon at midday, and then correcting this altitude of the sun with tables of solar declinations. This method would have enabled Mihuelo to pinpoint his latitude at all times. But the practical difficulties of taking an accurate reading on a heaving deck, using the published declination tables correctly, and being able to perform the mathematical calculations to reach an estimate of latitude, put this procedure beyond the abilities of many pilots of the 1520s. And besides, this difficult exercise was pointless because dead reckoning navigation was generally accurate and reliable. To go from Havana to the Rio de las Palmas, all Mihuelo had to do was follow a rudder and estimate his speed, plotting all of this information on a chart to keep track of his progress across the Gulf of Mexico. That is all. Standing at the port of Havana, he would easily have imagined the circular Gulf Coast as an immense clock. Directly to the north, at 12 o'clock, lies Florida. The Rio de las Palmas is located due west at 9 o'clock. Yucatan lies to the southwest at 7 o'clock. Mihuelo must have aimed his compass west at the Rio de las Palmas, or somewhat north of it. Unfortunately for Mihuelo, sailing from Havana to the Rio de las Palmas also meant that the ships had to brave the full force of the Gulf Stream, the fastest ocean current in the world. The Gulf Stream enters the Gulf of Mexico from the south, in the opening between Cuba and the Yucatan Peninsula, and after circling the Gulf, exits through the Florida Straits. The power of the Gulf Stream is staggering. It is equivalent to nearly 2,000 Mississippi rivers flowing together. 1.06 billion cubic feet per second, advancing through the ocean like an immense snake of warm water. It carries with it plants, fish, debris, and vessels at speeds that can top 100 miles in a day, or about 4 knots. At the Florida Straits, the speed of the Gulf Stream ranges between 1.5 and 2.5 knots, depending on the time of year. It invariably affects the speed and direction of sailing vessels. In the 1520s, European pilots were just getting to know this powerful ocean current. When Ponce de León's expedition met the Gulf Stream in 1513, the pilots were startled to realize that their ships were actually driven back, even though they had a favorable wind. Two ships close to the shore had to drop anchors to stay in place, but a brigantine that found no bottom was carried out of sight. The Gulf Stream kept surprising pilots for decades. In 1565, 30 years after the Narvaez expedition, an English merchant named John Hawkins, navigating on the Cape of Florida, suddenly ran into the Gulf Stream. "We felt little or none of the current till we fell with the Cape, and then felt such a current that bearing all sails against the same, yet were driven back again a great pace." The Gulf Stream was fully charted only in the 18th century. Mihuelo could only have had a very limited understanding of this current. Certainly no one at the time would have known just how much of a factor the Gulf Stream would be on the passage he was contemplating, as previous expeditions had taken more roundabout routes skirting the Gulf Coast. Because the Gulf Stream flows in a northwest to southeast direction as it exits the Gulf of Mexico, Narvaez's ships would have run almost perfectly against it. The first effect would have been to dramatically reduce the fleet's speed over the ground, protracting the sailing time and giving the impression that the vessels had traveled a far greater distance than they had covered. If the ships were beset by light airs or headwinds, they would have actually been dragged backward by the current. It is not clear how many days elapsed between the expedition's departure from Havana and its first sighting of land, but the pilots were clearly satisfied that they had sailed long enough to cross the entire Gulf of Mexico, when in fact they had traveled perhaps a third of that distance. Just as importantly, the Gulf Stream would have pushed the ship to the east, even if the pilots believed that they were following a more westerly course. The compass needles may have pointed to the west or a little north from there, but the powerful ocean current would have made the ships drift eastward in the direction of Florida. Narvaez's party first saw the mainland on April 12, 1528. Believing that they were relatively near but to the right of the Rio de las Palmas, the pilots turned the ships to the left as they approached the coast and began looking for familiar geographic features. What they saw must have been unsettling. The coast on the starboard side seemed to run north instead of south, and the sun set on the sea rather than on land, as it would have occurred at the mouth of the Rio de las Palmas. Undoubtedly, the pilots noticed these oddities, but probably dismissed them initially because judging the overall shape and direction of any coast is impossible at a single glance. Even if Miruelo and the other navigators were seriously concerned, they would have been likely to keep the full extent of their consternation to themselves. They had already embarrassed themselves in the Canarreo shallows, after all, and could ill afford any further loss of confidence on the part of Narvaez. And they had the facts on their side. They could be certain only of the two cardinal elements of dead reckoning navigation, direction and distance. They had traveled long enough to cross the Gulf of Mexico and in the right direction. The Rio de las Palmas simply had to be farther up along the coast. And so Miruelo and his fellow pilots made a bold and ultimately tragic proclamation. They declared the Panuco coast not to be more than 10 or 15 leagues, 30 to 45 miles ahead of them. At that moment, they sealed the expedition's fate. After the first sighting of land, the fleet spent two more days sailing alongside the coast until it came upon a shallow bay, unsuitable as a port, but where the expeditioners spotted an Indian village. The settlement consisted mostly of ordinary thatched huts. Across the bay was an island that was also inhabited. The royal controller, Alonso Enriquez, went there, and he called to the Indians, who came and were with him a considerable amount of time, and by means of exchange they gave him fish and some pieces of venison. On April 15th, Narvaez decided to have the colonists disembark. The ships pulled up as close to the shore as possible, and the sea-weary passengers began making their way to the land in small rowboats. The group had been significantly weakened in the course of the voyage from Havana. They had set forth with 80 horses, but nearly half of them had been unable to withstand the storms and died. The 42 remaining horses were now so feeble and sick that they could hardly be mounted or used effectively. The Europeans would have to do without their most decisive and lethal military advantage over the natives. But the horses were not needed. At the sight of the approaching ships, the natives had prudently decided to evacuate. The explorers were able to wander freely through the dwellings. They found mostly fishing nets, but they did turn up one rattle made of gold, which must surely have been an encouraging sign. Narvaez lost no time in claiming the land for Spain and for himself. Even though the expeditioners did not know their exact location, at least they were certain to be within Narvaez's enormous adelantamiento, somewhere between Florida and the Rio de las Palmas. As Cabeza de Vaca recounts, "Narvaez raised the standard on your majesty's behalf and took possession of the land in your royal name and presented his orders and was obeyed as governor just as your majesty commanded. For their part, the other high-ranking officers presented their own royal orders before Narvaez, and he promised to obey them. Had there been natives on hand to witness the curious ceremony taking place in their own village, they would have been thoroughly mystified." After establishing a camp, the arrivals turned to exploring their surroundings. Over the following 2 weeks, they mounted two reconnaissance expeditions. On their first foray, the marching Spaniards went north for much of the day, presumably following the coast, until in the late afternoon they stumbled on a very large bay that seemed to us to go far inland, Tampa Bay in all likelihood. The sight of this enormous body of water must have been as beautiful as it was disorienting. No European map contained any indication or reference to a large bay close to the Rio de las Palmas. The explorers returned to camp to share the news of their finding. Some days later, the reconnaissance party returned to the large bay and began rounding it. This time, the Europeans surprised a group of Indians and took four of them. The captives ended up guiding the strangers to their village, which was also on the bay about 12 miles ahead. As the visitors seemed especially interested in maize, the natives showed them a cornfield that was not yet ready to be picked. The first contact was volatile, with elements of coercion and cooperation, but ultimately resulted in a serious altercation. The Bay Indians were in possession of many crates belonging to Castilian merchants, and in each one of them was the body of a dead man, and the bodies were covered with painted deer hides. They had clearly come from a shipwreck, as Narvaez's men also found pieces of shoes, linen cloth, iron, and headdresses seemingly from New Spain. The Indians had evidently treated the deceased Europeans with great respect, carefully wrapping them in valuable painted skins. But Fray Juan Suarez, the would-be bishop of the Rio de las Palmas and Florida, quickly concluded that the devil had inspired this idolatry and had the crates and the bodies burned. These outsiders had become downright abusive. The Indians of the large bay also possessed some gold pieces. Upon questioning, a laborious and uncertain task, because there were no translators, the natives said that very far away from there was a province called Apalachee, in which there was much gold, and they made signs to indicate that there were very great quantities of everything we held in esteem. It is almost certain that the Indians were embellishing the truth in hopes that the intruders would leave. The explorers could see for themselves that the bay was poor and sparsely populated, so the mention of a rich indigenous province, perhaps another Aztec empire, inevitably piqued their interest. The leaders of the expedition now had to make a decision. They could go back to the ships to look for a more promising area to settle, or they could pursue this lead and march toward Apalachee. Narvaez did not hesitate. At camp, he called aside the highest-ranking members of the expedition, the royal treasurer Cabeza de Vaca, Fray Juan Suarez, the controller, the chief inspector of mines, a mariner, and a notary. To this small group, the governor revealed his intention to divide the expedition in two. All able-bodied men and horses would proceed on foot, going inland at times but keeping parallel to the coast until they reached the Rio de las Palmas. In the meantime, the ships would sail straight to the mouth of the river to wait for the overland party. Only crew members and women would travel on the vessels. It was a bold plan, but not an outrageous one, given the claims the pilots had made about the location of the fleet with regard to the Rio de las Palmas. Certainly, it wouldn't be the first time such a plan had been used. Other expeditions had resorted to this maneuver. Narvaez himself had done so in Cuba. As the column led by Narvaez had cut a swath from east to west through the middle of the island, a brigantine had sailed along the north coast, while some canoes commanded by Diego Velázquez explored the south coast. This three-pronged advance proved very helpful, as the ships carried provisions and provided intelligence, facilitating the work of the marching column. 15 years later, Narvaez was proposing the same strategy as a way of surveying his new adelantamiento. Within the small group, a clear majority supported the governor's plan. Fray Juan Suarez spoke in its favor, arguing that by keeping close to the coast, it would be impossible for the land party to miss the river and a certain port that Miruelo knew existed nearby. The Panuco coast could not be more than 30 or 45 miles away, according to the pilots. Suarez also reminded everyone of the many calamities that had befallen the expedition while at sea. Going back on board, he reasoned, would be tantamount to tempting God. He was through with sea voyages. With the image of the crates stuffed with dead bodies still fresh in his mind, Suarez preferred to continue on foot. The controller, the chief inspector of mines, and the sailor also agreed with Narvaez. They were either too tempted by Apalachee or too wary to go back to the ships. But there were dissenters as well. The notary, quite sensibly observed that the land contingent might run a grave risk by letting the ships go without first identifying a secure port to which all could return. The land party would be literally cutting itself loose from its only means of return to the Spanish-controlled areas. Cabeza de Vaca was more adamant still, according to his own account. He echoed the notary's reluctance to leave the ships without first having established a secure port. But his concerns went further. The pilots were unsure about their whereabouts, he pointed out, and the horses were in such weakened condition that they could not be used in any hostile encounters with the Indians. Moreover, the expedition lacked interpreters, and therefore had no certain information about the land that they were about to enter. Finally, Cabeza de Vaca pointed out that the expedition was running out of provisions. He estimated that each man could at most get a ration of no more than a pound of hardtack and another of salt pork. Cabeza de Vaca's is the only account of this gathering, and he wrote years later with the benefit of hindsight. Given what became of the expedition, it would have been very much in his interest to cast himself as the voice of reason in this decisive argument. Nonetheless, it is likely that either he or others did raise these points, and presumably they were discussed at some length. But in the end, Narvaez prevailed. The governor was a skilled soldier, a veteran of the New World, and a commanding presence supported by a majority. The riches of the New World were there for the taking, but they were destined for the intrepid sort. Hadn't Cortés shown as much in Mexico? Narvaez was determined to follow his star to Apalache, even if he had to alienate his royal treasurer to do so. Narvaez ordered the men to pack their belongings and procure as much food as possible. He also saw an opportunity to shame his royal treasurer in public. In the presence of others, Narvaez told Cabeza de Vaca to stay and take charge of the ships, since he objected so much and feared the inland expedition. That would have been a practical division of labor, but Cabeza de Vaca could not accept the implication of cowardice. He could not bear such an affront, and, as Cabeza de Vaca would later lament, I preferred risking my life to placing my honor in jeopardy. The married women also opposed Narvaez's plan. They would have to part with their husbands and face an uncertain destiny, fending for themselves on the ships. One of the 10 women approached the governor and flatly told him that he should not lead the men inland. She said that back in Spain, a Moorish woman from Hornachos had predicted that neither Narvaez nor the others would ever escape from the land, and if one of them were ever to come out, God would perform great miracles through him, but that she believed that those who escaped would be few or none at all. The woman on Narvaez's expedition was so persuaded of the divination she had heard that she went so far as to advise her fellow women travelers to give up on their land-bound husbands, and even urged them to seek protection immediately among the crew members, who would remain on the ships with them. The governor felt compelled to respond. Narvaez stated that those who entered the land with him would indeed need to fight many strange peoples, and even conceded that many of the expeditioners might die. But he also expressed his conviction that those who remained would enjoy good fortune and would become very rich. With their nerves somewhat frayed, the members of the land contingent said their last goodbyes to those on the ships, never to see each other again. Some 300 Europeans, a sprinkling of Africans, and 40 skinny horses became stranded in a completely alien world. Chapter 4. Walking Through Florida. Narvaez and his men ventured inland, confident that Panuco was no more than 30 or 45 miles away. After rounding Tampa Bay, they headed directly north. The Florida interior must have appeared to them like yet another kind of sea. The terrain was flat, endless, and except for occasional rivers and marshes, mostly featureless. In every direction, the verdant expanse stretched as far as the eye could see. For 2 weeks, the explorers walked through this enormous limestone platform covered in greenery. During this entire time, we did not find a single Indian, Cabeza de Vaca reported. Nor did we see a single house or village. And at the end, we came to a river that we crossed by swimming, because it had a very strong current. It took them one entire day to cross the river. Suddenly, the long Florida peninsula had turned into a blind alley, and a cruel irony. Almost within sight of Spanish-controlled territory, and yet so far from it. The tip of the peninsula lies barely 90 miles away from Cuba. On clear days, it is even possible to make out the shape of the island just above the horizon. But crossing the strait was impossible without ships. The closest European outpost on the mainland itself was Santi Esteban del Puerto in the province of Panuco. To get there by land, Narvaez's party would have to follow an excruciating roundabout route through the length of the peninsula, around the northern rim of the Gulf of Mexico, and down the coast of what is today northeastern Mexico. A journey totaling some 1,500 miles to Santi Esteban and 1,700 miles all the way to Mexico City. That was tantamount to the distance traveled by crusading knights as they crossed the entire European continent from Seville to Constantinople. Food was constantly on the minds of the explorers. When the ships and the overland group became separated, every man had received 2 pounds of hardtack and 1/2 pound of pork. Such measly rations could not have lasted more than a few days. The men were forced to rely for food on Florida's rich variety of flora and fauna. As Narvaez's men skirted marshes or walked under canopies of pine trees, they spotted 3 different types of deer, rabbits, hares, bears, lions. The largest feline would have been the Florida panther, geese, night herons, and other wild beasts. Among them, one that carries its young in a pouch, an unmistakable description of the opossum. Interestingly, they did not report seeing any alligators, creatures that would have been especially startling to New World newcomers like Cabeza de Vaca. But despite the natural bounty that surrounded them, the group was hard-pressed to find food. For weeks, their paltry meals consisted almost exclusively of hearts of a certain palm tree, possibly the sable palm, that appeared to the explorers to be similar to an edible palm that grew in Andalusia. It would take time before they learned to use the environment more effectively. For the moment, they lived like castaways in the midst of a green ocean. Despite their hunger, the explorers were still able to subdue other humans. As soon as they crossed the river with a strong current, possibly the Withlacoochee River in modern-day Citrus County, they found about 200 Indians. Cabeza de Vaca recounts how Narvaez went out to them, and after having spoken to them by means of signs, they gestured to us in such a way that we had to turn on them. The Indians were threatening the Europeans. In Florida, rivers served as important boundaries between different groups. These borders were guarded and enforced. As soon as they crossed the river, Narvaez's men had entered into the territory of a new community. Here, they were treated as trespassers. During the skirmish, the Spaniards captured 5 or 6 Indians who led them to a village about 1.5 miles away. This Indian community had plenty of ripe corn. It was a little oasis in the middle of the endless piney flatlands. Aching with hunger, the Spaniards devoured the corn ravenously. It must have tasted like salvation. "And we gave infinite thanks to our Lord for having aided us in so great a need," wrote Cabeza de Vaca. "Because since we were most certainly new to these hardships, beyond the fatigue we suffered, we came very worn out from hunger." The intruders feasted here for several days. But all was not well. During this time, the rift between Narvaez and Cabeza de Vaca deepened. The royal treasurer had wanted from the outset to remain close to the coast and re-establish contact with the ships as soon as possible. Yielding to the majority, he had been forced to march inland. After 2 weeks of arduous marches, Cabeza de Vaca had become ever more convinced that his plan was the right one. And now the friars and the other royal appointees had come to see the wisdom of Cabeza de Vaca's caution and began to close ranks behind him. They all beseeched the governor to send scouts toward the coast, which was not too far from there, according to the Indians. The river with a strong current, that they had only recently crossed, could well turn out to be the elusive Rio de las Palmas, or perhaps a good anchorage would be found at its mouth. Or maybe they would find the port that Mihuelo had said was near the Rio de las Palmas. The ships might even be waiting there. Narvaez, however, had no interest in embarking on a long detour to the coast. He had his sights set ever more firmly on Apalachee. The governor had been questioning the Indians about this rich province, and they all pointed north. Finding the Rio de las Palmas was now only a secondary goal. At first, Narvaez would not even hear of any plans to go to the coast. "We should not bother talking about this. It is too far," he replied to the pleas of his men. However, after much insistence, the governor finally consented to send a reconnaissance party. And since Cabeza de Vaca was the most adamant about surveying the coast, Narvaez ordered him to go with 40 men. They would have to go on foot. The next day, Cabeza de Vaca departed for the coast, accompanied by Captain Alonso del Castillo and his company. They walked until noon, when they arrived at some sandbars and a shallow bay. Cabeza de Vaca, Castillo, and the men walked into the water to test its depth. They found no suitable anchorage or port. They walked for nearly 5 miles, and the water never reached higher than their knees. Oyster reefs made the march especially difficult, cutting the soles and feet of the men. Narvaez dispatched another party of exploration a few days later. This second group confirmed that the bay was shallow and contained no port. They saw no signs of the ships, although they did notice some Indian canoes crossing from one side to the other. Cabeza de Vaca's bid had failed, and now it was time to act on Narvaez's plan. The expedition resumed its grueling march toward Apalachee. The specter of hunger returned. At times, the trekkers went for 20 miles or more without finding any corn. They did not, however, encounter any hostile Indians, although indigenous lookouts must have monitored the Europeans carefully throughout their journey. The long, monotonous march was only punctuated by occasional encounters. One day, a group of Indians fearlessly made their way into Narvaez's camp. They were led by a native lord who was being carried on the shoulders of a porter and who was covered with a painted deer hide. Some other Indians in his entourage were playing reed flutes. To the Spaniards, it must have seemed like an apparition or a dream. Narvaez spent an hour in conversation with this lord, who was named Dulchanchelin. He and Narvaez were able to communicate only through signs, and what conversation there was must have been painstaking as well as inaccurate. But Narvaez was determined to question him about Apalachee. He gave the lord beads and bells, and in return, Dulchanchelin took off his precious hide and passed it to Narvaez. The Spaniards understood that these Indians were sworn enemies of the people of Apalachee and were very willing to point the strangers in the right direction. The Indians and Spaniards walked together until they ran into another large river, perhaps the Suwannee River. An impatient cavalryman by the name of Juan Velazquez rode straight into the river. The current was so strong that he was swept off his horse, holding tightly to the reins, which caused the horse to drown too. Dulchanchelin's Indians told the Spaniards where to look for Velazquez's body. They also found the dead horse. The hungry explorers were able to feast on the carcass. After a month and a half of marches, the terrain began to change. The Spaniards had walked for so long since leaving Tampa Bay that the trees now appeared taller and more majestic, and the air had turned somewhat cooler as the tropical portion of Florida gave way to a more temperate climate characteristic of the continent. At last, sometime in mid-June of 1528, the men came within sight of Apalachee. Everyone cheered. The hunger, exhaustion, and sore backs from carrying heavy weapons seemed to vanish. As Cabeza de Vaca wrote, "On finding ourselves where we desired to be, and where they told us there were so many foodstuffs and so much gold, it seemed to us that a great portion of our hardship and weariness had been lifted from us." It had been exactly 1 year since the Florida expedition had departed from Spain. Apalachee was indeed the largest and most complex chiefdom of the entire Florida peninsula. In fact, it was something of an anomaly. Thus far, the Spaniards had encountered native peoples organized in small villages scattered over large areas. The size of these communities was dictated by the amount of food available. Although some of these groups cultivated maize, they were primarily hunters and gatherers. Their diet depended on a wide variety of animals, including deer, seabirds, turkeys, alligators, rays, and sharks. Indians who lived near the coast also feasted on oysters and other delectable mollusks. These food sources made for varied and delicious meals, but they also put a limit on the number of people who could reside at a single site. As communities grew in size, so did the strain on their immediate environments, eventually leading groups of families to move into unoccupied areas in search of more plentiful resources. Apalachee functioned in a very different way. This chiefdom occupied a surprisingly small area in the Florida Panhandle, bounded by the Ocilla and the Oshlaconee Rivers. Yet it was a land most favored by nature. Although the people of Apalachee lived relatively close to the coast and had access to estuarine resources, most of their food came from rich upland soil known today as the Tallahassee Red Hills. This extraordinarily fertile strip of land facilitated the intensive cultivation of maize. By the 16th century, the people of Apalachee had cleared large fields that stretched for miles and were regularly cultivated by communal labor. Corn sustained human communities many times larger than were possible anywhere else in Florida. It also fostered stability, large surpluses, and power. There was a dark underside, however, to this agricultural bounty. The need to coordinate and mobilize large numbers of people for the clearing, planting, and harvesting seasons inevitably led to greater centralization and inequality. Unlike the other Florida groups, who were relatively egalitarian, Apalachee sustained an intricate hierarchy. At the top was the paramount chief, a figure associated with the life-giving sun. He wielded the power of life and death over his subjects. He also exerted control over various village chiefs who ruled their own localities. In turn, each of these village chiefs was assisted by lesser officials charged with specific functions, down to the lowly farmers who constituted the vast majority of the people. This hierarchical arrangement also prevailed among settlements. Apalachee had a center, a capital city known as Anhika, where the paramount chief resided. From Anhika, he projected his influence over a series of outlying local capitals, which were more modest settlements. The village chiefs resided in these local capitals, ruling over their surrounding hamlets and farmsteads. Apalachee was only one among dozens of chiefdoms that flourished between AD 1000 and AD 1600 along the fertile floodplains of the Mississippi River from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico. These chiefdoms were part of a remarkable cultural tradition along the mighty river and its tributaries. They practiced intensive agriculture, became organized as highly ranked societies, and took part in long-distance trading networks. They were the most powerful chiefdoms north of Mexico. Present-day scholars call them Mississippian societies. Their temples, houses, and square-based pyramids proclaimed their might. Once dominant, these centers began to falter. Some Mississippian centers, particularly those on the upper Mississippi, went into decline, and in some cases collapsed prior to the arrival of Europeans. The site of Cahokia, the largest Mississippian chiefdom, just east of present-day St. Louis, was abandoned well before Columbus. Other centers experienced precipitous declines around the age of discovery. These societies were already wrestling with problems of endemic warfare and environmental degradation when the arrival of Europeans hastened their demise. By the time French and English colonists explored the upper reaches of the Mississippi in the 17th and 18th centuries, This remarkable cultural tradition had virtually disappeared. All that remained were the imposing silent mounds. Despite these earlier collapses, some chiefdoms on the lower Mississippi were still thriving by the 16th and 17th centuries. Centers like Natchez, within the present-day state of Mississippi, and Apalachee in Florida, carried on this centuries-old cultural tradition well into the colonial era. They persisted long enough to have to confront powerful and overbearing outsiders. Narvaez's men came within sight of an Apalachee village without being seen. Comprising 40 small houses, it was certainly more substantial than any other they'd encountered along the way, but it was still quite disappointing when measured against their exorbitant expectations. The expedition had probably arrived at one of the outlying local capitals, and not Anhika proper, which would have contained 200 houses or more. The village that Narvaez and his men found was surrounded by thick woods and many lagoons with trees sticking out of them. Narvaez ordered Cabeza de Vaca to take 9 cavalrymen and 50 foot soldiers and attack the village. As they made their way inside, they discovered that there were only women and children. All the indigenous men were gone. But sometime later they returned, and having learned what had happened, shot arrows at the strangers and killed at least one horse before they withdrew. The Europeans kept the women and children as hostages. 2 days later, the Indians asked for the release of their families. Narvaez agreed, but in return demanded that the village chief be turned over to them. He was to remain as a hostage. Superior weapons gave the Spanish undisputed control of the settlement, but not much more. Native warriors reverted to guerrilla tactics to dislodge the intruders and force the release of their leader. They were unpredictable, skillful, swift, and relentless.